Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jennifer Haig, whose latest novel is The Condition. Earlier novels are Baker Towers and Mrs. Kimball. The Condition is set in Boston, Massachusetts area, where you live now. All of your novels deal with family issues, which I guess is something that you didn't quite expect when you started writing, that you'd suddenly have this pattern, or did you kind of know instinctively that you would be dealing with family issues in your books?
No, it's been a surprise to me. I always start writing about something else, and what happens is, for me to write well-developed characters, I need to know something about where they came from. And I find myself getting so interested in all of that, that it becomes part of the story.
The condition is actually how everybody lives, but specifically something called Turner's syndrome, which one of the characters has, and I want to say develops because it's genetic. What is Turner's syndrome, and how did you find out about it?
Turner's is a chromosomal glitch. It happens only to girls. Essentially, this means that a girl will never go through a normal puberty. She never matures physically. She matures mentally and emotionally, but physically, she doesn't achieve her adult height. Her body remains childish. I've known about Turner's since I was a kid, I guess. I went to school with a girl who had it, although I figured that out in retrospect. At the time, I didn't know there was a name for it. But a few years ago, I was researching another novel, one I ended up not writing, and just by happenstance, I came across an article in the medical literature about Turner's. So I recognized it immediately, of course.
And you began doing research on it.
Yeah. It's a tough condition to write about because it's very hard to generalize what Turner's syndrome means. It means wildly different things in the lives of different women. There's a pretty broad spectrum. There are women with Turner syndrome who are, for all intents and purposes, perfectly healthy, and others who have very ominous health problems, and there's everything in the middle.
There's a comment made by Gwen, the girl with Turner's, her father, about how people with Turner's tend to not do so well in math. The impression I got in the book is that Gwen has no problems with math, and her father is kind of bouncing a stereotype at her.
Sure, and that's one of Gwen's frustrations in dealing, well, with both of her parents. She has a different set of frustrations with each parent. Her father is a scientist. He's a cell biologist at MIT, and he looks at Gwen in such an extremely clinical way that everything she does or says, he's trying to figure out how this is emblematic of a girl with Turner syndrome. So he's not really seeing her as an individual kid. She is a female with Turner's, and her mother sort of does the opposite thing, where she's in such deep denial about the Turner's that she can't even bring herself to talk about it.
Turner's itself, I mean, it's just the person just stays young-looking for longer, stays like a child until eventually the woman turns into a short woman, pretty much, right?
Pretty much. I mean, there are other consequences besides being short. Women with Turner's generally can't have children of their own, so there's that, of course. Also, physically, the body shape is a little bit different from the average adult woman, although that varies a lot, too. You know, there are women with Turner's who are tiny, tiny, and others who are just a little bit shorter than average.
There's a quote I have from you, which obviously plays a role in this book, not merely with the character Gwen, but with her mother, and actually with all of the characters, male and female. I'm wondering how conscious this was in writing this book. What you say is how women are treated relates to how they look, that it's a genetic lottery. No one deserves to be beautiful and no one deserves to be plain. And, I mean, this is specific in terms of both Gwen and her mother's aging process, but it's specific also in terms of the men. Again, how conscious was that overarching idea in writing the book?
It's something I sort of saw clearly after I'd written the book. I don't know how other writers work, but this whole idea of writing about themes has never seemed natural to me. I write about characters, and it's only later in looking at what I've written that I can sort of tease out the theme of the story. That wasn't at all an agenda I had going into the writing of it. It came out in the process of writing.
Well, when you're getting into the characters and looking out through their eyes, I mean, that's got to be something that's always playing a role, just as it plays a role in your life and in my life.
Yeah. You know, it's something that Gwen has had a lot of opportunity to reflect about. She's very aware of the science behind Turner syndrome. She knows how statistically unlikely it is that she was born with this condition. She understands all the ways in which her life would be radically different had that gone differently.
Jennifer Haig, when you're creating characters, and since you're not necessarily working with theme, and this is a character-driven novels, How much do you figure out in advance? What do you know and what are you looking for?
When I start writing the book, I'm not actually writing chapters. I'm writing about the book for about the first 6 months. So I'm writing biographies of the characters. I'm writing very detailed descriptions of the places where they live, that sort of thing. So that by the time I sit down and start writing chapter one, I know a lot about who these people are. What I don't know is what exactly is going to happen in the book. I don't know what the events will be. I may have one or two in mind, but often as I get into the writing, I find that those aren't actually correct, and the characters wouldn't do or say the things I once thought they would.
What did you have to discard that way?
I don't know that I had to discard anything. It was more that I wrote in a kind of suspense where I didn't know where the story was going until it got there. The one thing I did have in mind was that Gwen would fall in love. This does happen in the book. I'm not giving away too much because, of course, you know, the book jacket tells you this much. But Gwen, at age 34, falls in love for the first time. She's never really had a boyfriend. This happens, and it's really a seismic event in this family, and it really turns everybody inside out. She's got these very protective parents and brothers, and it sort of shifts the whole order of things in this family. So that was the one thing I knew.
Did you know that you'd be working over a 30 or 40-year span?
I suspected it. This seems to happen in all my novels. 25 to 30 years seems a natural chunk of story for a novel for me. That's not to say the events of the story last 30 years, but including sort of what I know of the character's past, it adds up to about 30 years. And I think you need that many years to see how people's lives turn out. And that's really what I look for, both as a writer of novels and as a reader of novels. It's a way to explore how people's lives turn out.
There are five main point of view characters. There's Gwen, there's her brothers, Billy and Scott, and her parents, Frank and Paulette. You've said that Scott is kind of your favorite character. It's kind of obvious because as the book progresses, he seems to take over more and more of the book.
I'm not sure that's so, because the first chapter where Scott appears is actually the longest chapter Scott's in. But I'm not even certain that Scott is my favorite character. I think he was on the day I was asked that question.
Oh, really? No, it seemed to me as I read the book that he became more and more central. The other characters, Scott's wife, Penny, did you have it in your mind what would happen with her?
No, and I don't want to say too much about it because it would give away too much story. But I didn't know that at all when I started writing the book. I had sort of a picture of their lives together in the moment, at the present of the book where the story starts. But I didn't know where that was going to go, no.
The character of Billy, the gay character, which we find out pretty early on, is that based on anybody you know?
It's based on almost everybody I know in a certain
way.
And, well, it's true of all these characters. You know, they're such composites of people I know from life. It's really hard to tease out. It's like trying to find the ingredients in a smoothie. You know, you turn on the blender and it all gets all mixed up. Yeah, I mean, there are elements of a lot of people I've known in Billy.
And I would guess also in Paulette.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Paulette comes from an old family, an old Massachusetts family, and you've said something like only in Massachusetts or on the East Coast can you have somebody who is the way she is, which is that her entire past, her entire family is kind of ingrained within her.
Mm. That may be a slight exaggeration. I'm sure variations on this exist in many places, but there is a particular brand of obsession with the past that you find in New England. And Paulette is of this very old Massachusetts family, as you've said, and she's very proud of what her ancestors have done in the past. Even though they haven't done much for about 200 years, she's really up on the most august points in their history, and she loves to talk about them. She lives in a very old house in Concord, Mass., and she knows the history of this house, even though it's not particularly a house from her own family. She's terribly identified with the past. And this is part of the problem between Paulette and her husband, later becomes her ex-husband, Frank. Frank is a scientist. He has no interest in the past. He's only cares about the future. So from the get-go, they have a, kind of a disconnect between the two of them.
One thing I found interesting is that you made choices to leave certain things out. There are reconciliations at the end of the book that don't appear in the book, but they're there. And that was deliberate, or did you write them and decide to remove them?
No, I suppose it was deliberate. And so much of the structure of a novel is about what's not on the page. It's as much about what is absent as what is present. And as a reader, I don't always think about these things, but as a novelist, I always do. A lot happens in between the chapters. Days or months or years pass, and you're constantly making these choices about what goes in and what stays out.
The character of Frank comes from a Pennsylvania mining town, which is where you come from.
Well, I come from that part of Pennsylvania, not precisely the same town. I found that useful because Frank is not of the same kind of family that Paulette is, and that's very intentional on my part. I wanted him to be from some different world entirely, so he's not infected by the same sorts of preconceptions as Paulette is.
Are you looking specifically at class there, or are you just thinking of background?
Well, I'm thinking of class. I'm thinking of background, certainly. He's sort of a curveball in her life. Marrying Frank was not sort of part of the program. It's, you know, had profound consequences.
Is there really a captain's house in Truro?
There are loads of them. I mean, there are, you know, it's invented, of course.
You know Truro on Cape Cod pretty well?
Yeah.
You go there?
I have.
Why'd you choose that?
It's a town I like a lot. Yeah, it's a landscape I'm really attracted to. And to one degree or another, all my books are really tied to the landscape.
The island in the Caribbean. I mean, you use real places. You use Concord, you use Pittsburgh, you use Truro. Why did you choose a fictional island?
Every novel is a sort of amalgamation of what is real and what is imagined. It's true that some of those locations are real and some of them are come out of my head. The advantage of making up a place is that you get to create it to your own specifications. You have absolute control over the geography. Everything is where you want it to be. It's very expedient for the novelist. But also, this experience of Gwen falling in love with Rico, there's an element of fantasy to all of it, too. And she could not and would not have met and fallen in love with a man like this in the basement of a museum in Pittsburgh. It had to happen somewhere else entirely.
Well, yeah, obviously, but it could have been St. Croix.
Sure. I'm not quite sure how I made that choice, to be honest. I can't say there that it was something I deliberated over a lot.
Did you go down to the Caribbean and do your own research?
I've spent a lot of time in the Caribbean, you know, just vacationing and diving.
Did you sit around and chat with the dive people and find out what their lives were like?
Oh, I've been doing that for years and years, long before I had the idea to write this book. There's a really kind of fascinating sociology to people who drop out and live in the Caribbean, and I've known a lot of them over the years.
And the boys that she meets, that Gwen meets down there, you talk to boys like that?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Jennifer Haig, your career, you began as a short story writer primarily. Let's go back a little further. Did you always know you wanted to write? Is that something that just happened?
Yeah, I've always written. I don't know that I thought about making a career of it. It's just something I always did from the time I was a little kid. You know, I've done other kinds of work as well, but writing is something that I would do regardless, I think. I'm one of those people who can't really think properly unless I have a pen in my hand.
Well, what other things were you doing?
Gosh, I mean, I was a really wonderful career waitress. I have cleaned office buildings at night. You know, I've been a yoga instructor. Like many of the writers I know, I've had this very checkered career path full of strange pivots here and there.
And at what point did you begin writing short stories and getting him into a position to actually sell them? Was that after college? Or?
I started writing them when I was very young as an undergraduate, but it was years before I was any good at it. And the first many years of writing short stories, nothing there was publishable, and I knew that they weren't. I just did it because I loved to do it. So there was a pretty steep learning curve for me. It took some years.
And then what happened?
Then I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I got an MFA in fiction writing, and it was while I was a student at Iowa that I first published a short story. I'd been writing them for a number of years before that, and I was gradually sort of figuring out how it's done. But it takes a long time to teach yourself to do that.
Well, who did you work with in Iowa?
Frank Conroy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he was a giant. He was a wonderful teacher. I had Frank Conroy and Ethan Kanan, Marilyn Robinson, James Allen McPherson.
Well, I know that Ethan talks a lot about the importance of voice, and I guess you must have taken that one to heart because the condition deals very strongly with different voices.
Yeah, it does. One of the things Ethan talks about a lot as a teacher is how important it is that a character be deeply imagined, and I think that's a thing he does extraordinarily well and has been doing for many years. Each of the characters in the condition kind of gets equal time on the page. So although it's easiest to talk about the book in terms of Gwen, in fact, you know, the other characters are at least as important as she is.
What do you think Conroy taught you?
Frank had very strong convictions about the difference between a bad sentence and a good one. He was really the very best at articulating why prose is good and why it isn't. And he sort of shamed you into writing better sentences. You really didn't have a choice.
Have you internalized his voice so that when you're rewriting, you just hear him going, this is good, this isn't?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think I always will. It's really, it's a wonderful thing he does for all of his students, did for all his students.
You're listening to an interview with Jennifer Haig, whose latest novel is The Condition. Well, when you left Iowa, is that when you suddenly realized, hey, I might have something saleable here?
No. In fact, I sold my first novel while I was a student at Iowa.
Oh,
so
okay.
I had started writing it a couple of years before I went to Iowa.
That's Mrs. Kimball.
Mrs. Kimball, yes. And I finished writing it in my first year at the workshop. So it was around that time that I found an agent and a publisher. So by the time I left the workshop, the book was sort of in the pipeline. It wasn't yet published, but it was about to be.
Then it took a few years before Baker Towers.
Yeah. It takes me probably 3 years per book, something like that, maybe a little bit less for Baker Towers. But, you know, there's a certain kind of incubation period that happens where I think I'm writing on a cellular level. It doesn't look like I'm getting anything done, but I'm sort of turning the characters over in my mind.
So you take the long walks and just kind of like feel out who they are but then they surprise you.
Yeah, sure, they do. On occasion. I'm not a Nabokov kind of writer who, you know, he had absolute control over his characters. He used to say, my characters are galley slaves. And I would not say that about my own. There are moments where I have an idea about where I'd like the story to go, and I find it doesn't make psychological sense that this character would not do or say this thing I would really like him to do.
It sounds to me that you knew not only that Gwen would have the relationship, but there's a certain point you knew that at the end of the book would be a family gathering. I mean, that seemed pretty obvious that it was moving in that direction for a long time.
Yeah. It starts with one and it ends with one.
Yeah.
There's a certain symmetry to that.
And that family gathering, there are revelations in that family gathering. At what point did you realize that that would be the moment?
Probably within days of writing those scenes. Writing the end of the story is always fraught with anxiety for me. I believe that there really is only one correct ending for every story and thousands
really?
Of wrong ones. And so writing the first draft is pretty miserable for me because I'm writing in constant fear that I won't hit on the right ending for this story. It's sort of this fear that you can't land the plane. And if you can't land the plane, it doesn't matter how good the takeoff was. So I worry a lot about that. And I don't know until I get there, really.
Well, what would have been a wrong ending?
Anything else. You know, I think all those characters ended up, well, I hope that they ended up where they should have ended.
You said before that there was a novel that you worked on that didn't go anywhere. How far did you get on that
one? No, I've had plenty of those.
Really?
Sure. From one book to the next, there's always at least one miscarriage. And I think of it as sort of the rebound relationship. You know, it's you go through the breakup, and then there's somebody you have to date sort of casually, and it's sort of doomed from the outset because you're carrying so much baggage from the last. And I always have at least one of those in between the books.
Do you actually get any writing done, or does it kind of just fade away midway through the thought process?
Sometimes I actually write on them for a little bit. Luckily, I've never spent 10 years on a miscarriage, but I have spent certainly a few months at a time.
And they're all there so that if suddenly you realize that this is how I can do it, you can go back to it, of course. No?
I doubt it will ever happen. But
really?
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I've never had the urge to go back to something I've put down.
So you don't ever see any picking up any of these characters, for instance, down the road?
Well, I've never written a sequel, but I wouldn't rule it out. You know, it's sort of an arbitrary choice for a writer where the story begins and where it ends. Implicitly, all these characters lived before page one, and they live on beyond the final page. So it's not out of the question. I will say, though, that I'm already excited about something else, so it's not going to be the next book.
Is it tough for you a year after you finish a book to suddenly go back and have to rehash and bring up all this stuff when your brain is on another planet?
Oh, yeah, it's really difficult, you know, and I know all writers go through this, but invariably the book comes out just at the point where you finally got your legs under you and you have something new that you're dying to work on. It's sort of like falling in love with somebody new. And then your ex starts calling. It's just what you don't want to have happen.
Jennifer Haig, in writing The Condition, the character of Frank is a biologist. You're not a biologist. When you're doing research on that, how deep do you have to get and how instinctive do you think it is to put in just the right amount, not too much or too little?
I think it's pretty difficult. Because you're writing in a point of view, you really can't explain things that this character already understands. Yet, presumably, you're writing for a reader who is not a cell biologist and needs a little bit of background. For me, it was really challenging just to understand Frank's work, never mind translate it into terms that everybody will understand, never mind make that interesting and relevant to the story. So it's, in fact, three or four separate tasks, all of them pretty difficult. In order to understand the work Frank does, I had to just talk to a lot of people. And that involved being willing to look really stupid, you know, asking idiotic questions of people who are really very smart.
And the politics of faking papers and getting admitted into various academies and stuff like that, that also had to be done as well.
Oh, yeah. I live in Boston, and, you know, if you throw a book out a window in Cambridge, you will hit a scientist. There's no question. So there are lots and lots of people to talk to about these questions. And I'm sure that's where the desire to write about it came from. You know, that's the world I live in, so of course you draw from what's around you.
There's a point where Scott suddenly realized that he was probably ADD growing up. Was that the moment that you realized that he probably was, or was that somewhere in the back of your mind and you just decided to use it?
I probably realized it very shortly before Scott realized it. And the way Scott was as a child, that was something I had known for some time. In the first chapter, you see Scotty as a little boy. So I knew what his behavior was like, what a handful he was as a kid. But the idea of having him come to this realization about himself, no, I wasn't planning on that. I wasn't writing toward that. And I realized that this was the right thing to have happen, probably a few pages before the reader does.
And the fact that Billy is gay, I guess, came up fairly early on.
Yeah.
And that you know that the perfect son would be gay, which is a little bit of a stereotype. But
I suppose it is, but, you know, it's impossible to write anything that is realistic without having some of it seem familiar. You know, it's sort of a delicate dance that realistic novelists have to do. Of course, you want to write what is fresh and original, but you also want it to be true. And much of what is true in life is familiar to us because we've seen it, you know, again and again.
Did you find writing him Billy, easier or harder than the other characters?
It really depends on the day. You know, there were days and weeks where a character comes easily, and then you get a little further down the road, and you hit a bump, and you don't know what to do with them. On balance, I wouldn't say any of these characters stands out as the most difficult or the easiest to write. They all kind of pose their challenges. And one of the great things about writing a novel like this is that when you get stuck with one character, you can focus on somebody else for a while.
Were you writing in sequence, or were you able to go around into different chapters? Because they're kind of separate.
They are separate, but by and large, I write things in the order they appear in the book. I've never been able to shoot ahead in the story to sort of fast forward to something else, because I don't know what the events are that sort of fill up that interval in between. So in order for me to figure out what the story is, I kind of have to write it as it comes. There are sort of sections of the past, sections of backstory, that maybe I didn't write absolutely in sequence. And those were the times when I would, you know, be blocked with a character and I would sort of move on to something else. But then I would be generally writing about the past rather than the next event in the story.
A lot of writers that I've spoken with talk about serendipitous moments. Writing is puzzle solving. The secret of good writing is it's always about the puzzle. Make them not puppets, make them real, get them from point A to point B so that that's the only place they have to be. And sometimes you hit a snag and then suddenly a light bulb goes off and you figure it out because of something you've already written.
Yeah, I think so. I think the answer to what comes next always lies in what's already on the page. I won't say it lies in the last sentence necessarily. Maybe
right.
It lies in the last chapter. But it's always encoded in there somewhere.
Can you think of any instance where out of the blue you suddenly went, I got it?
This isn't maybe precisely what you're asking about, but I think it's related. In my first novel, Mrs. Kimball, it's structurally sort of a strange book. It's a story in three parts told from the point of view of the first wife, second wife, and then third wife of the same man. So it's a triptych. It's a modular kind of storytelling. The challenge in that book was to have the reader get interested and involved with one of the Mrs. Kimballs and then put her down and force the reader to spend time with a new Mrs. Kimball. I think the first shift was not so difficult, to go from wife number one to wife number two. But by the time I got to the third Mrs. Kimball, it seemed to me, no, the reader's going to resist this. You know, here we are 200 pages into this story. The reader's already gotten emotionally involved with two wives. We're going to dump those two now and go to wife number three. This isn't going to work. It's the classic problem of the third act entrance. You know, how do you make that character engaging? And I wrote a first draft where it didn't work at all. So I was talking over this problem with my reader, a writer friend of mine who reads all my first drafts. And he is a guy who believes that the answer to every fictional problem is somewhere in Moby Dick. Now, I'm not that big a Melville fan that I necessarily get behind that, but he believes this strongly. So I was talking with him about this problem. He said, well, what you need is a Bulkington. And Bulkington is a minor character who appears early on in the book and then appears again much later. And you recognize him and you think, oh, Bulkington. And you have this moment of recognition as a reader, and so you sort of accept this new character because you've seen him before. So that's what I did in Mrs. Kimball. I built in a Bulkington. The third Mrs. Kimball, actually, I built in to the first act of the book. She's what seems to be a minor character in Act One of the book. And then she appears much later as the third Mrs. Kimball. She's a Bulkington. And it really does work. The reader has met her and recognizes her, and you have this sense of, you know, running into an old friend in the street.
When you're dealing with family, you are dealing with issues that involve race, class, politics, religion. When you're writing a book that spans many years, understanding that in essence, it's a book written in the time it's being written. I mean, that's what it is. But when you're doing that, how conscious are you of your own ideas bubbling to the surface? And how do you deal with that? Do you just try to ignore it? Do you let it bubble in? How does that work?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, for instance, you have your own political ideas, your own ideas about race, religion, and some of them are going to come up. But you're not going to try to be didactic about it. But yet, a number of writers I know have difficulty, particularly at this particular time, in keeping themselves out of the book because you don't want to write about how much you hate Bush.
Right, right. I can't say that I find it very difficult because if I'm deeply identified with these characters, it seems like it has nothing to do with me. And I think part of what makes it easier is that I have no autobiographical instinct, none whatsoever. And for a long time, I thought this was a shortcoming of mine as a writer. And maybe it is. I'm not sure. I know loads of writers who do draw very heavily from their own lives. I've never learned how to do that. And I think maybe partly it's my desire for privacy, but maybe it's more a sense of inferiority, that if something has happened to me, it's not interesting enough to find its way into a novel. So my own experience is it's almost beside the point from the get-go when I'm writing novels. I write characters with whom I agree and characters with whom I disagree on almost everything. And I can't say one is more difficult than the other.
When Frank and Paulette find out that their son is gay, something he's been hiding for a long time, they don't really care.
It's so anticlimactic, and you so feel for Billy in this moment. You think all that angst over all those years, and...
But it's normal.
Yeah. You know, it's for Billy, it's one of the central dramas in his life. It's something he's coming to terms with. It's not that central for anybody else. And isn't that true of all of our, you know, our own struggles with our identity? It's always more compelling, more interesting, more important to us than it is to anybody else.
Well, by the same token, Scott suddenly realizes late in the book that people aren't thinking about him. They don't care.
They almost never think about Scott. And that's a blow to him, of course.
Paulette's manipulation. Did you know that would always be there?
It became more clear to me as I wrote her. I can't say that was the way I defined her to myself at the outset. I defined her in terms of her past, her childhood, where she came from. The ways she behaves in the book, that sort of emerged in the process of writing the chapters.
And finally, the title, The Condition. What brought you to that title in particular?
You know, I believe that for every book, there's a right title that you'll find or you won't. And sometimes you just have to go out with the wrong title. In this case, I think it's the only possible title for this book. On the surface, it seems to be a title that refers to Gwen. I mean, that's the obvious, you know, connection, the Turner syndrome. But in fact, every character in this book is struggling with a condition. This is a family of people who consider themselves fundamentally defective, every one of them. And they're all sort of struggling to make peace with themselves. And this... something I didn't know when I started writing, but I certainly knew at the end. It's a book about our time and that we live in a moment when so much of human experience that used to be just part of life has been medicalized. You know, there's a treatment for things that generations ago nobody thought needed to be treated. And all these characters, in one way or another, are so ridiculously aware of their shortcomings and so desperate to perfect themselves that they create a lot of misery in their own lives. The corollary to this is that they're very aware of the defects in the people around them. And I think we all have this experience. We're all the healthiest, most well-adjusted people in our families, and everybody else is more screwed up than we are. Well, this family is no different. Every person in this family is so aware of the ways in which everybody else is messed up. So the only people who are more flawed than we are, of course, our immediate families.
Well, I also noticed that all of the characters pretty much spend the entire book running away from each other, even as they stay in touch. I mean, it's all about running away,
yeah,
just hiding from each other. They all hide everything from each other.
Oh, gosh, yes. And, you know, it's interesting. A reader of this book knows more about all these people than they know about each other. This is a family of people who has never learned how to talk to each other. They're very secretive. Because it's written in this very close point of view, you really get inside the heads of all five people, and you know secrets that they will never divulge to each other. In a way, it's the way we never get to experience family life, because each of us gets to be only one person. You can't be both the mother and the father and the sister and the brother. In this case, you get to be every member of the family, and you get each person's perspective in a way that makes you understand where all these people are coming from, and none of us really gets to do this in our own family.
Was it easier or harder to choose a point of view for the times that they're together, picking which one is going to perceive any particular sequence?
Yeah, it's a big choice, because you want to choose the person who sees and perceives the most interesting things. And sometimes that's not the person who's doing the most interesting thing. It's the person who's watching what is being done. So it's a really important choice. And those scenes where you have the whole family together, I agonized a little bit over that.
Jennifer Haig, you said you're working on a new novel. Is it also multi-generational, several years?
Yes, it covers about the same time span as this book does, if you include, you know, the backstory, the past of all the characters. And I've not yet found a way to write a novel that doesn't include those things. And again, it focuses largely on a family.
Have you started writing it, per se?
I've done a little writing. I don't know if any of it will be kept. You know, there's a certain amount of throat clearing at the beginning of the writing process.
Well, when you say I've done a little writing, that doesn't mean chapter one. What does it mean?
Well, in this case, it does mean something.
Oh, really?
Chapter one. Yeah. So I am that far into it. I did spend 6 months or so just writing about the characters, writing about the situation. And I actually reached the point of starting to write pages, and then I'm putting it down briefly to promote the condition.
Have you done the research for it? I mean, is there a lot of research in this one?
This particular book has less than the condition did. At least I think so, from what I understand of it so far.
At a certain point, you have to suddenly put everything down, get online, and begin making phone calls?
No, I put everything down when I go out to promote a book. But in terms of doing research, it's not really separate from the writing process. I do a little research on the front end, but then there's more research that comes later on. I don't know what I need to know until I reach that chapter often.
If place is so important to you, then defining place, then you've got to be pretty accurate, right?
Yes, depending on the book. And sometimes they're invented places, and then I can just kind of let fly.
Yeah, and sometimes they're real.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard from Hollywood about any of these books?
Mrs. Kimball has been optioned a few times, and at the moment it is not under option, but it's been optioned 3 times. So it's nice when that happens. I can't say I've ever had aspirations in that area, so it's nice, it's gratifying when someone from the film industry is interested in the characters, but it's not something I think a great deal about until it happens.
Do you see yourself getting back into short stories at any time? Have you continued to write short stories?
I still write them once in a blue moon. A short story takes about half as long as a novel does for me. They're really very slow. You know, I always have one going in one stage or another, but I can only work on one thing at a time. So typically, I'll work at a short story when I'm between drafts of a novel, or maybe when I've finished a novel and haven't yet begun a new one.
Well, one final question then about drafts. You know, most people just keep writing on a computer these days. It's changed from the old way of churning out a draft. When you talk about draft, what exactly are you talking about? Getting it to a perfect point and then starting from scratch again?
Well, I'm sort of old school in that I write everything by hand.
Oh.
So I've never composed a novel at the keyboard. I've written short stories that way, and I still do occasionally. But a novel, to me, needs to be written on paper. And I think part of it is that I'm just such a fast typist. I type about 90 words a minute, so that when I'm composing at the keyboard, I can easily become a little glib. You know, I'm moving so fast, I'm smacking away at those keys, I'm making a lot of noise, I feel very productive, but I'm writing it from a very superficial place. And often I look at the work the next day and think, I can't keep any of this, you know, this is all garbage. Whereas when I'm writing by hand, I'm much more mindful. I'm much more deliberate in choosing this adjective over that one and drawing the comma rather than the semicolon. They're much more deliberate choices. And I think the quality of the prose reflects it. I just write better by hand. So a first draft to me is getting through the story once. Typically what I do is start the day writing by hand. I compose by hand for as long as I can stand it. And when I can't stand it any longer, I go to the computer and do sort of a second draft, where I transcribe what I have and add things and cut things and move things. And so it is, in effect, two drafts in one day of the same material. The next day, I start composing again by hand and move further into the story. So by the time I get through the story once, it's actually a second draft I have, and it does exist in an electronic form.
And then at that point, it goes out and comes back again? I mean, you send it to your reader?
No, I don't send it to anybody. Well, it depends on the book. It depends on how bad the draft is. My first drafts are hideous. I really, there's no kind of spark of anything in the first draft, typically. So often nobody will see it. And I'll go through it a second time before I let somebody take a look. And then it will go to my one reader, yeah.
How do you know it's done?
Well, you know, my favorite part of the writing process is the final few months. And that's where I do nothing but sort of jeweling of the prose, where I'll sit at the computer and I'll spend the whole day putting in commas and very happily taking them back out again. I love to punctuate. You know, I don't know that I'm the greatest writer in the world, but I'm a pretty good punctuator. I'm quite vain about my punctuation, and I love playing with that to get the rhythm of the sentences exactly right. When I find myself putting in the same commas and taking the same ones out again over and over again, I know, okay, someone needs to take this thing off my desk now. I've done what I can do.
And that's it.
That's it.
You've been listening to an interview with Jennifer Haig, whose latest novel is The Condition. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.